Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today we're at the tail end of the Feast of the Dormition, very late on the 28th of August, 2018. As always, I want to thank those who have donated to me, because in doing so, they're keeping me on the air. They're keeping me functional. Consider any money sent to me as a kind of a Molotov cocktail thrown into the faculty lounge at any big university. Any faculty meeting with them is pretty much, it's the same thing. All these guys listen to me. I know they do. They'll never admit it, of course, but they do. Because what's happening in academia today, of course, is completely stagnant, conformist. No one lives in fear like a white male university professor, and they have a tendency to overcompensate by trying to out-left the left, which, as we all know, never works. Giving in never works. Giving in is just a sign of weakness, and they'll simply pounce all the more. Today we're going to talk about modern Orthodox life. I have a paper out. It has a long and unwieldy title. It's called The Deliberate Absurdity of Patriarch Bartholomew, The Dionysian Consolidation of Masonic Control at the Fanon. But I pick every one of these words deliberately. To some extent, you have to look at world orthodoxy as a whole with a certain sense of humor, else you're gonna go nuts. The blatant lack of canonical regularity that these people have is very easily remedied. And you realize that they're responding to power. Now, it's simply false, and in fact heretical, to hold that you're saved according to who your bishop is. Bishops don't mediate grace in the Roman Catholic sense. Bishops are there to regulate the organization of priests and parishes and monasteries and stuff like that, to defend the faith, to they're supposed to be the monk, the high priest of the diocese, and is autonomous to the extent that he maintains the faith and proper morals. But he's no more than that. He's not this figure of God on earth, as the papacy sought to be. Now, the present Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew, and I say that with a certain irony, because I don't believe for 2 minutes he's a legitimate bishop of anything. This man isn't a candidate for baptism, let alone bishop for anything. His comments and statements and activities are so outrageous. Archbishop Averke refers to our struggle as the true Orthodox, or the suffering Orthodox, was his phrase. And the world Orthodox oppose us. Now, because you're not saved according to what jurisdiction you belong to, that's absurdity. Grace is open to all baptized Orthodox people. All the bishop can do is point you to it. They're not holier than anybody else. They don't have more grace than anybody else. They don't have any greater access to God than someone else has. And they're really nothing special. Now, ideally, they're supposed to be the most experienced, most profound Orthodox monastic in the diocese. But that's only very rarely the case, because your best monastics don't want the administrative tasks that a bishop has to deal with. And in some cases, a bishop maintains his distance from that and hires someone else to take care of the administration, and often that person then takes over when the bishop dies. That's been the case in many areas, because they don't want the life of a bishop, which is a very worldly life, to interfere with their monastic rule. Now, I say Dionysian, that it's a Dionysian consolidation of Masonic power. Dionysius is, I mean, to put it very simply, it's an irrational, feminine, and almost a semi-sexual, something that's opposed to the rational, the normal, the natural. The Dionysian form of rule has no systemic foundation. It's organized by threats, by violence, by perception, by propaganda, by manipulation, whatever they have to do to keep people in line. But the problem with the Dionysian kind of rule, the complete, utter illegitimacy, is that it leads people who suffer from it from my favorite Greek word, abulia. It's my favorite word because it typifies modern life. Abulia is a complex word because it doesn't just mean lethargy. But I know I've mentioned this in other programs, but abulia is a pathological lethargy that comes from the belief that there is nothing worth fighting for. And as far as Old Rome and New Rome are concerned, that's where their people are and that's where they are. Whenever you read anything from either one, either Pope Francis or Frank or Bartholomew, it's really hard to take it very seriously. They invent canonical tradition. They invent liturgical life, and reflect what powerful people believe. It's almost a non-cognitive commitment to this kind of irrationality. But this is the power center that all elites have today. You know, these are emperors without clothes, and they're confident that no one will say anything. To the new Orthodox, people like Bartholomew, you know, Lutherans are more Orthodox than guys like me. And many years ago, there was a tremendous schism in Orthodoxy, which we roughly call, you know, old calendar versus new calendar, but as very, you know, catch-all terms. Those who are traditionalists usually are royalist, nationalist in one sense or another, very traditional, very patriarchal on the old calendar, and hold that, you know, the truth of God is in fact a divine object, versus those who rule by a Dionysian new order. But they're, you know, whether it be traditionalists in old Rome or new Rome, they rule, I mean, you know, they're opposed by the Dionysian irrationality around them. Many years ago, for 8 years, Bartholomew, as a bishop, was the vice president for the World Council of Churches Faith and Order Commission. Now, I've said a million times, and I have on my website and everything else, that they reject Christ as the sole savior of the world. They come right out and say that. And the Orthodox members sign this. So to be an active member of the WCC is to tacitly and explicitly accept this nonsense. And I could go on and on and on about the Antichrist things that this organization says. It's founded by the Rockefellers and financed by corporate America. I can't be in communion, certainly, with anybody who's a member. And his real first name is Demetrius. And from 63 to 68, his graduate studies were at the Pontifical Oriental Institute in Rome. Then he went to the Ecumenical Institute, Bosnia and Switzerland, then university in Munich, Maximilian's. And adding insult to injury, his doctoral research was on canon law, of all things. And then before becoming bishop, he became a visiting professor at the Gregorian University in Rome. So his entire education and professional practice before becoming a bishop was within the ecumenical movement or the Roman Church. Now, before the Nikonian schism in Russia, and even for some time afterwards, someone like that coming from this Western background, remember, these guys aren't really Roman Catholics. these are Novus Ordo, you know, do whatever you want kind of nonsense. This isn't pre-1960 Catholicism here. This is a complete chaos, liturgically speaking. But these men, you come from a place like the Gregorian, you have to spend some time in a monastery because they need to be cleansed or whatever they may have picked up abroad. Needless to say, that's not done anymore. And of course, he was never a monastic. He never served in the monastery, even though bishops are supposed to be monks. Because being an abbot of a monastery meant that you trained in both ruling others, pastoring others, mentoring others, and administration. But that's rarely the case today. Today, Bartholomew sits on another Rockefeller institution. You know, they're all over the place. And it's really a Jewish organization. It's called the Elijah Interfaith Institute. Now, of course, Elijah is not referring to the prophet, because those two would have nothing in common. I'm not entirely sure which Elijah they're referring to, but it's certainly not him. It is a theosophist Masonic organization and a Judaic organization, which officially is under UNESCO, but for the most part, it's an ecumenical Jewish organization. Now, I've noticed that this group recently has spent some time condemning some of the real anti-Gentile racism in Israel. Rabbi Yitzhak Shapira has written a book, your typical Talmudic style, that the goyim exists only to serve Jewry, and that Jewry would be formally superior over the whole earth at the end time. Yet, almost all Jewish religious books have said this since the Talmud itself. So here you have this Jewish group very piously condemning a book that says what the Talmud says, but of course they don't reject the Talmud. We're supposed to say, you see, they're not those kind of Jews. But it's doublespeak. The things that they condemn in Shapira's book are in the Talmud that they accept. There's a letter that they wrote on this, signed by Bartholomew, among others, very pompously states, we are working together under the aegis of the Elijah Interfaith Institute to bring the light teachings of Judaism that cohere to this worldview. Love of your own group should not be equated with the hatred of others. Israel's calling is harmonious with the well-being of all humanity. Now, this is the sort of nonsense that this, you know, the exact opposite of that is what the left has been saying for decades. White people or Russians or Orthodox people are nationalists on those grounds. It's assumed to be hateful to others, which, of course, is non sequitur nonsense. But in this comment, from an ultra-liberal organization, says that only Jews get to be nationalists, and their exclusivity is not inherently anti the other. Now, the Institute picked this very easy target. The book is only in Hebrew, and they piously condemn its racism. But then they say that Judaism alone has a right to be exclusive. They're just not meant to say it very loudly. They say this too. We've been collaborating on a project developing contemporary Jewish approach to other religions that would make our students and communities aware of the dangers inherent in such extremist views in our tradition, and that would inspire a broader view of Judaism, its ethical task, and its vision for humanity. Now, you note the Masonic Talmudic wordplay. It's not that Shapira's ideas are wrong. It's just that holding it with any kind of vehemence is dangerous to Jewry. Now, what this says is that they indeed believe that all Gentiles are one day going to be ruled, but just yelling it from the housetops right now is dangerous. And then they say, as if giving legitimacy to these views, our scholars stand by ready to debate the views under discussion. The same people who say that revisionists and others are beyond debate. Now, the devil, literally in this case, is in the details. Listen to footnote 3 of this letter. Why it's in a footnote, I don't know. But we are painfully aware that such problematic theoretical teachings can easily become transformed into practical guidelines for action, as witnessed by the horrifying acts like the Hebron Massacre by Goldstein in 1994. We also recall some tragic lessons from our own history, the actions of Israel's enemies in the past century, applying a perverted logic that we should not replicate within Jewish teaching. For example, the right to kill children lest they grow up to threaten us was cited by Otto Arendorf of the German army Eitzen's group in C, and at trial justify his unit shooting of tens of thousands of Jewish children among the more than a million Jews murdered by the shooting squads in Eastern Europe 1941-1942. There's certainly an arcane reason why that's a footnote, because they essentially summarize the entire letter and their condemnation of Jewish racism in that, in this footnote. And it's a footnote to be able to say that we've said this and we've justified it, even though we've condemned it at the same time. Now, when I read this, I was really wondering why would they use Orndorff, of all people, use to justify and explain the racism of that rabbi in Israel. It's a very arcane argument. It's a very obscure set of events to reference. And because of its obscurity, it's suspicious. Now, of course, like all things concerning the Holocaust, it's pure mythology. Himmler, I'm no friend of Himmler, but he made it clear in instructions to the SS in this respect that Jews were to be put to work and children were never going to be harmed. These stories largely come from the Soviet Union, who had an interest in covering over their own crime. But he never stated anything about killing children. No one ever said, including Orndorff, that children were to be killed. Very few men could actually kill children. Very rarely. You have to be on so many drugs to be able to do that. When someone says they've killed children directly, you know, with a rifle or something like that, unless they're on drugs, I don't believe it. Or they're psychotic. And it's just very strange that a full summary of the letter is in a footnote, and that they mention this very obscure figure. No, there are others. I mean, you know, he eventually condemned this alleged testimony, which he said was given under torture and given they promised him that they would go easy on him if he gave some credence to this. There were a lot of German testimony against the Third Reich that were obtained in this way, either by torture. This torture will continue unless you talk like this. And that we'll go easy on you. We'll go hard on these other guys. We'll go easy on you if you talk and give us the evidence that we require. And I was fascinated by this fact. I was fascinated by why this is in a footnote and why do they mention him? To think that the German army and the USSR, fighting for their very lives, running out of ammunition, running out of supplies, and starving in many cases, is going to waste all this manpower by killing kids for no good reason. They verified 60 kills, executions of partisans that had committed some crime. But even liberal historians like Kershaw, he says that in the Eisatz group in trial, former head of the group D was able to get his co-defendants to submit to a line of defense put forward by him with the suggestion that if one had from the beginning carried out the extermination operations against the Jews on order of the Führer, they could count on a more lenient sentence. Those people who followed the trials, and this was post-1945, Nuremberg, which the chief prosecutor was Jewish, Benjamin Ferencz. And Ferencz comes right out and says that I'm making stuff up. And why would he even admit that? He says, yeah, I go into a village. This is a direct quote from him. I go into a village where an American pilot had parachuted and beaten to death and line everyone else up against the wall and say, anyone who lies will be shot on the spot. But it never occurred to me the statement taken under this duress would be invalid. Which is a full admission that he's full of it. But why admit this? Why talk about such an obscure figure in this letter condemning Jewish racism? And then, of course, compare it to the massacre of Hebron. Goldstein was a Jewish settler from Brooklyn who shot up the mosque near the Temple Mount. And some people, you know, why are you spending so much time on this little footnote in a fairly obscure letter? That was signed by Bartholomew, but still. And my question is, well, why do they use it? So the letter states, this is the last thing it says. we recognize that there are voices in our tradition, meaning the Jewish tradition, that have lost sight of these great principles because of the unspeakable suffering that our people have undergone throughout history. So remember, they're condemning this rabbi, but of course they can't. They become rodef, and are liable to execution by other Jews. A Jew that gives over another Jew to Gentiles is subject to execution, depending on the circumstances. But what this letter says is the evils perpetrated by Jews are not evils. They're justified by their alleged suffering. But have you ever heard a Jew saying, oh, Ukrainian nationalism is bad, but we have to understand the roles of Jews in Poland and the USSR as precipitating factors? The problem that these guys say is that it's not that the rabbi's views are false, but sometimes as guidelines for action, they lead to error, and they can lead to a backlash against their people. Now, I mention all this and spend so much time on it because it's classical Dionysian power. It's based on command, the creation of a new reality, not thinking. The thesis here is that, you know, the ecumenical movement, the liberal movement in churches has no canonical or traditional foundation at all, not in scriptures, not in the canons, not anywhere. So they have to invent it. And not to mention, I mentioned this letter too, because it's really a classic example of Talmudic doublespeak. It's how they use these kind of things to create their own narrative. Most people wouldn't even have heard of this trial, 1948, in fact. And so they'd have no reason to, or no way to make any kind of statements about it. But this issue also goes to the heart of who Bartholomew is. I hate to remind him, but the Orthodox of the world were pro-Hitler until it became impossible. The only exceptions to this were in the USSR. I've covered this many times before. But this letter just struck me and it stuck out because it's such a classic example of doublespeak, of the nature of his liturgical and ecclesiastical revolution, and how, in all cases, Jews are at the root of heresy. Let me give you another example here. And, you know, I find it, before I sit here and talk about his ecumenism and everything, that's been done 1,000 times over. Masonic control of the fine art, that's been done 1,000 times over. But one example that hasn't been spoken of very much, and something that I had forgotten all about, was the alleged assassination attempt on Bartholomew. I believe it was 2011. I'm positive it's 2011, we're very close to it. Allegedly, there was a plot amongst Turkish army officers to shoot Bartholomew on May 29th. In other words, would be the 560th anniversary of the fall of Constantinople. Now, I remember reading about this, and I very quickly forgot about it because it was dropped by the news. There's very good reasons to believe that it was made up. They don't explain how they could possibly know that that was the reason that they were going to, you know, on that particular anniversary. This operation and assassination, you know, allegedly comes from a cabal of Turkish officers. But it's doubtful that a Muslim group or the Turkish secular military would plan anything like this, at least in part because Bartholomew has shown nothing but deference to Turkish nationalism and Islamic movements throughout his career. He served in the Turkish army from 1961 to 1965, and he's a Turkish citizen. Not sure why they would want to kill someone who's sympathetic to them. And as always, the only nationalism that he opposes is Orthodox. In my view, it was a Mossad operation. It was to implicate Israel's enemies and draw Greece and Israel closer together. Turkey is an Islamic state, secular, with the second largest army in all of NATO. It's larger than all the other armies except the US put together. In the Israeli mind, what if Islamic fundamentalists took over Turkey? Or a group of militarists connected to the Ba'ath Party or something like that. What would happen to Israel then? There's no way Israel can defeat Turkey head to head. Military coups are an important part of Turkish history. Setting Greece in the West against Turkey would be an ideal situation. We talked about this last week on the Israeli support and diplomatically and otherwise, of the Turkish invasion of Cyprus. Not to mention it would lead to Tel Aviv being kingmakers. It also may have been designed to purge problematic officers from the immense and fearsome Turkish army. Here's what a Turkish newspaper wrote in 2011 at the time. The plot to kill Bartholomew is thought to be part of the CAGE Operation Action Plan, a subversive plot allegedly devised by military officers that sought to undermine the government through the assassination of non-Muslims and other acts of terror. The CAGE plan is allegedly drawn up on the orders of the Erkincan, which is military intelligence. The CAGE plan documents specifically refer to the killings of Armenian Turkish journalist Hrant Dink, Catholic priest Father Andrei of Santoro, and three Christians in Malatya in the so-called operation. Most of you have never heard of this operation before, and with very good reason. The man detained by the Turks was sort of a drifter, a lifelong criminal, a man probably incapable of carrying out crimes like that. He was a hired gun at most. These kind of operations often use guys like this, long criminal records. They could be killed with impunity later on. No one misses them, and no one's going to come forward with evidence supporting them. They're very easy to manipulate. But this is classic Mossad, not Turkey. I mean, they never killed Makarios III in Cyprus, but a cabal exists to murder a pro-Islamic bishop? As always, nothing adds up. Assassinations are politically charged events, and it always is connected with manipulating the population. Because this is a traumatic event, it makes those witnessing it and being a part of it very suggestible. It creates the chaos from which the adepts can extract the new order. It's rarely done to actually kill someone, and those who get blamed for it are rarely involved. It doesn't make any sense. From a terrorist point of view, it makes absolutely no sense. A nationalist Turk would have no reason to eliminate Bartholomew, which he knows would invigorate Greek and Orthodox nationalism, create sympathy for the Patriarch, and of course probably detach Turkey from NATO. But Bartholomew is aware of what happened after the 1981 assassination attempt on John Paul II. There, too, the alleged assassin was a Turk. It immediately raised his stock in world media. It galvanized Polish Catholics into effective action. Even there, too, though, the rationale for his attempt was very shaky and has yet to be solved. Allegedly, the Bulgarian KGB and the Turks were involved. Most journalists covering this, though, the guy who allegedly was going to shoot the Pope was Mehmet Akka. He had probably nothing to do with it. He had no obvious political or religious beliefs. And at the same time, it also boosted Catholic respect for Fatima. It was done on her feast day. And it even gave John Paul II the right to claim that it was, in fact, the third secret of Fatima. It was invaluable to his papacy. Now, in 2010, Akka, the alleged Turkish assassin, denied everything and said that Cardinal Castaroli was at the root of it, that it was an internal Vatican matter. He made up the story about the Bulgarian involvement, knowing full well that if it was ever traced back to Bulgaria, the party in Poland would be in big trouble. The Castaroli connection makes sense. Assassinating the Pope would be a disaster for his enemy. Castaroli was an anti-communist and applauded the Pope's election due to its likely effect on Poland. If he was behind it, it would increase John Paul's popularity, like all assassination attempts do. The Bulgarian story, which Akka said himself, was that the KGB in Sofia, working with Soviet intelligence, Yuri Andropov, needed the Pope dead. In a trip to Bulgaria, the Pope himself condemned this theory. Don't think that what happened in 1981 was lost on Bartholomew. It would make his popularity soar, make Turkey look like a terror state. So who benefits? Patrick Bartholomew, acting like nothing happened, he says, when the CAGE plan was revealed, we thought the raid could be a part of that plan. At the time, we thought that they were just trying to scare us. Then it says, Patrick Bartholomew is grateful to the security forces who uncovered these dark plans. It's a very satisfactory development that the police and prosecutors have been revealing those dark plans so those responsible can be captured and tried. That's kind of odd language for someone who's in fear, who just uncovered a plot to kill him. He added no security to his entourage. And he mentions these unnamed security forces. But of course, he's referring to the Turkish army, because they were protecting a Turkish citizen and soldier. This is typical Masonic doublespeak language. He thanks the Turkish army for saving him from the Turkish army, of which he was a member. It says, Sledgehammer is a suspected coup plot, allegedly devised in 2003 at a military gathering. According to the plan, military would foment chaos in society through violent acts, among which were a planned bomb attacks on the Zayed Mosque in Istanbul. The plot allegedly sought to undermine the government and lay the groundwork for a military takeover. But would the chaos benefit them? Look, when it doesn't make sense, it's usually not true. Using terms like cage and sledgehammer are meant to inflame the population, to create this kind of mental chaos. Mental chaos benefits the new order, not them. But today, of course, no further information has ever been given on these guys. No one's mentioned it since. What happened to it? Do conspiracies like this just fall apart on their own, with no one noticing or taking credit? Of course not. Not a single member of the military was ever arrested. But the same military was very quick to defend the Patriarch. It was a fake assassination attempt. It was to draw attention to a man who believes that he should be at least as popular as the Pope of Rome. He does believe he deserves a greater audience. He's complained about it before. I've seen his speeches at the UN where no one's there. But it's failed. This operation, if it existed, would only benefit him. So silly games like this show the nature of what the Fanar is. And why, you know, it's classic Machiavellian Dionysianism. Now, I don't know if Bartholomew was actually a member of the Lodge. I haven't uncovered much information in that respect. His predecessors certainly were. You could be Masonic and not be a member of the Order. You could just be, you know, following, carrying that out. And I should remind our listeners that the Patriarch of Constantinople, that see itself, is not large or powerful. It certainly has money, but it doesn't have that many parishes. Most of its bishops are titular, named for underwater cities or cities that are long gone, which makes them uncanonical. And it isn't really all that influential. The Russians have all the numbers. Constantinople is always playing catch-up with the Russians, and it could be a very real split between Russia and Constantinople over Ukraine. Anyway, under his predecessor, Demetrius, the policy of communing Roman Catholics became official. Demetrius added the Pope's name to the diptychs in 1972 and simply was a recruiting tool for the True Orthodox Church. That church, which I am a member, the Russian Orthodox Church under Vitaly, that was founded by Vitaly of the Synod Abroad, now under Metropolitan Damascene of Moscow. And it was only stymied by its own internal schisms, which is the disease of the True Orthodox Church. But while the Fanar itself is one big lodge, evidence for Bartholomew's membership is, as far as I can tell, very, very slim. And really, you can't be made a bishop there without at least that tacit acceptance. He could be Masonic without being a Mason. But worse than these foibles, worse than this nonsense that he's a part of, I didn't realize this until fairly recently, or if I did, I blocked it out. He's openly condemned the Synod of Chalcedon and all the synods that came after it. In November of 1998, papal delegation visited the Fanar. It was then that he gave probably his most outrageous quote. Now, he was referring to those who had anathematized the Pope of Rome and the Monophysites. And he says this. Now, listen closely. I took this from Father Michael Eskel's book, 2017. Listen to this. Those of our forefathers from whom we inherited this separation were the unfortunate victims of the serpent who was the origin of all evil. They are already in the hands of God, the righteous judge, and these men, being the causes for the schism, are now in the hands of God, the righteous judge. Now, it took me a while for that to penetrate. The fathers of the church, through really the first millennium, both at Chalcedon and all the synods that came afterwards, as well as the anathema of the Pope of Rome in the 11th century, they're not just wrong. They were possessed and are damned to hell. This is the so-called Pope, the Orthodox, who has taken an oath to uphold the teachings of those he now condemns. He has officially rejected Chalcedon and all the synods that come after because each one of those cites Chalcedon as an authority. But a major part of his mission is to maintain and institutionalize the already existing communion between Old Rome and New Rome. And as I say many times, and Orthodox forget this, the Church of Rome bears no resemblance to its own church of 50 years ago. The liturgical tradition has been thrown out entirely. Starting in 1971, it was made illegal. Yet the Council of Trent, Canon 7, said if anyone condemns these rites and the other symbols that we use, like vestments and everything, let him be anathema. But what replaced the service that came out of Trent, is why we call it the Tridentine service, it's largely an inspired, Protestant-inspired service written by a committee, 69-70, and you have Bugnini, who was a Mason, by the Masonic name Buon, and working with Paul VI to rewrite the tradition. And like all of these guys, they say the new Mass is based on ancient practices. They never bothered to tell us what ancient practices they're referring to, though. If you remember, 10, 15 years ago, Philip Saliba of the Antiochian Church in America eliminated fasting from Easter to the Ascension. Each time I've read about this, they've said that this was the ancient practice. I have asked numerous people to cite me, because I can't find it in Greek and English anywhere, where that was done. I'm still waiting for an answer. This is 15 years ago. I'm still waiting for an answer. These documents have never been found. The Church of Rome today has really no liturgy to speak of, since you can invent it as you go. It's a permanent revolution begun precisely at the same time the papacy reversed itself on the Jewish question. And of course, I was an altar boy in the Novus Ordo. Only the unions retain any kind of real liturgical tradition, but they're free riders from Orthodoxy. The ancient Mass, Tridentine and before, is one of the most beautiful objects in history, but was banned for decades. And today, while it's permitted on occasion, really is only done by those in societies that specialize in the Latin Mass. But the church that they're talking about communion with isn't even Catholic. We know what Pope Frank has been like. I watched him on BBC video in 2013 say this: if a person is gay and seeks the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge? Catechism of the Catholic Church explains this point beautifully, but says, wait a moment, how does it say that person should never be marginalized and they must be integrated into society? The problem is not that one has this tendency. No, we must be brothers. That is the first matter. I'm going to say to Pope Francis, and I'll say it once, any man who stuffs fecal matter into another man cannot have a good will. That is not love, that is not sex, that's nothing. They are mentally ill freaks. He'll say that Catholic traditionalists and monarchists are evil, but homosexuals are good Catholics. Better even. For both Romes, the only people out of their church are its most sensitive and pious members. And Frank was rewarded with exaggerated positive media coverage. He's well aware that homosexuals are never marginalized. If they were, he wouldn't even mention them. They aren't integrated in society, they are society. Every word that this man says is dripping with ill will and contempt. It can't be described in neutral terms. He denies hell in 2013. He says, they are not punished. Those who repent obtain the forgiveness of God, enter the rank of souls who contemplate him, but those who do not repent and cannot therefore be forgiven disappear. There is no hell. There is a disappearance of sinful souls. Pretty sure he invented that doctrine on the spot. Now, there may be some truth to the soul's death in certain cases, but he's placing the whole weight of the papacy behind it. His view is that these souls die not because of sin, really, but this is the only way that sin is punished. Both New Rome and Old Rome, there's only really two sins, and that's racism and homophobia. We know that Christ spoke more of hell than he ever spoke of heaven. Francis is aware of this. Both of these men deny the entire gospel. But so long as the press showers him with awards, he remains happy. The press more or less ignores Bartholomew, but he's also given positive media coverage. Just like Bartholomew, from at least John Paul II, Pope of Rome believes that Talmudic Judaism represent the chosen people. By virtue of their race, Jews exist as superior to all others, as the Talmud itself intones. In 2011, Francis wrote this. There is a phrase from the Second Vatican Council that is essential. It says that God showed himself to all men and rescues, first of all, the chosen people. Since God is faithful to his promises, he did not reject them. The Church officially recognizes that the people of Israel continue to be the chosen people. Nowhere does it say, you lost the game, now it's our turn. It is a recognition of the people of Israel that I think is the most courageous thing from Vatican II on the subject. Well, it takes no courage to take orders from the most powerful group in history. It only takes courage to defy them. For Francis, it's like defying God himself. That the Old Testament Israelites, or even remotely the Jews of today, take such a leap of faith that only the most ignorant could possibly believe it. That this 4,000-year-old group of people maintains the same theology as the prophets is equally absurd. The Talmud condemns the prophets. The Talmud condemns the Old Testament. But the church fathers to a man condemned in Judaism, Frank and Bartholomew have resuscitated. The followers of the Talmud, he calls, are chosen people. And if they're chosen, they're superior to Christians. Christians are inferior by virtue of not being chosen. He denies Christianity, he denies the Trinity, he denies the prophets, who condemn just these men. But both of these guys know exactly what they're doing. Now, while Francis gets positive media coverage, the media, while they like him, they condemn the church as a whole for this child molestation issue. Now, I've mentioned this before, but finding the database of everyone ever accused in America in the 20th century and 21st century exists online. All you have to do is search for it. I've been through this. Oh, there's thousands of people on it. A tiny handful have been convicted of anything. In fact, a tiny handful have even been arrested for something. In other words, there wasn't even enough evidence for, you know, basic probable cause. And those handful that actually were convicted, actually did something, were all treated very harshly by the diocese. They usually have priors. They're usually sloppy. The DA's political career could be made with a high-profile case like this. So this is largely a make-believe issue. There's a tiny handful who've been involved. The public school system is far worse in this respect than the Church of Rome. I'm no friend of the Church of Rome, as we all know, but this is a concocted issue. So while they love Frank on the one side, they act like this is just one big brothel on the other side. These men are a lot of things, but stupid is not one. I mean, they know, and this is why I mentioned the Dionysian element here. They know that popular ignorance is so intense, they could say anything. Anything is Christian to be believed. Few good teachers remain. So what do you have? You have institutions. It's institutions rather than doctrine that makes someone a Christian. That's what public ignorance does. You have people out there so benighted that they say to be Orthodox is to be recognized by the Patriarch of Constantinople. I've dared these people to try to find some canon or anything that says that. Or with some ancient tradition that no one knows about, apparently. But when you're that ignorant, that's all you have left is the institution. The one doctrine of the Soviet patriarchy was one doctrine, and that was you have to be a member of the institution to be Orthodox. Doctrine is not important. Membership of the institution is all important. And to even have it, using phrases like, you lost the game, now it's our turn, that he reduces it to some kind of game, that he speaks in such flippant language. All the church fathers, no exceptions, said that the Orthodox Church, Orthodox Catholic Church, East and West, was Israel. Constantinople was called the New Israel, as well as the New Rome. Same thing for Kiev. These men actually say that the Talmudist is the same as Israel. That's called blasphemy. The hierarchs of world orthodoxy cooperate with both these guys, and they sign joint declarations with them. They'll defend them all. He says this in January of 2016, Francis said this, "Brothers and sisters, I am happy to be here with you in this great synagogue in Rome. Our relationship is very close. Back in Buenos Aires, I used to go to the synagogues and met with community gathered there. I would follow Jewish festivals and commemorations and give thanks to the Lord, who gives us life, who accompanies us over the course of history. A spiritual bond has been fostered, an authentic relationship of friendship inspiring a common commitment. Interreligious dialogue is fundamental, that we encounter each other as brothers and sisters before God, that we respect and appreciate each other, try to cooperate. Jewish-Christian dialogue, there's a unique, particular bond, virtue of the Jewish roots in Christianity. Jews and Christians must therefore consider themselves brothers, united in the same God by a rich spiritual patrimony." That's from the Vatican website. Francis is not a stupid man. He knows that a tiny handful of Jews actually believe in God. But he admits here that he follows Jewish festivals, that he followed the Jewish calendar, that he prays at the synagogue back in Argentina. The Pope of Rome rejects his own church and his own see, and the papacy itself, but he follows the Jewish calendar most Jews ignore. There's no dialogue here. It's a Jewish anti-Christian monologue, and has always been. To be brothers with someone, it's not just we like the guy, it's that we have a spiritual communion. And he says right here that you have to accept Judaism before you could even begin talking to them. So they are the chosen, everyone else comes under them. He's well aware that Christianity doesn't derive from what he thinks Judaism is. Modern Judaism is based on the Talmud and the Zohar, not the first five books of the Old Testament. That's exoteric doctrine that's given to the Goyim. In terms of doctrine, of course, they both completely reject the Old Testament, and they most certainly reject the prophets. So even if the Jews did care about it, France couldn't mean this literally anyway. The scholars of the Vatican are well aware of what the Talmud says about Christians in general and Christ and the Mother of God. But notice, you know, the devil's always in the details here. He comes right out and says that the God of Judaism is also the God of Christianity. But does this theoretical Jewish faith that he, you know, pretends to know accept God and Trinity? Well, no. So this is a very sneaky way of denying it, since it doesn't matter how God is conceived. The denial of God himself. The implication of all this kind of garbage is that God has never really revealed himself. And all this religion stuff is all just a human invention. He's talking about two powerful social institutions, not the revelation of God. Even more, if someone is alienated enough to believe this bile, then they are most certainly part of the anti-Christian Jewish patrimony that he speaks of. So, going back to Bartholomew, I want to cite something else from him. "We do not hold that exclusivity means judgment or exclusion. The idea that membership in a visible church organization is requisite for membership in heaven is based on a false paradigm, that we somehow parallel the kingdom of God in this world. The kingdom of God is not an exterior reality, it is interior, at least until the end of time." Yes, the man who speaks over 10 languages said that exclusivity doesn't mean exclusion. This is a mockery of language. It's doublespeak. When he's referring to institutions, he is not referring to doctrine. These men are the same ones to say that unless you're recognized by Constantinople, you're not Orthodox. Then he says here, membership in a visible organization is not requisite for truth. In other words, we don't have it. He denies the city of God on earth. He denies his own church. He denies his own position, his own see. But he does it in such a sneaky way that if you read it quickly, you won't get it. Like Francis in Rome, he denies his own church. Bartholomew says, in reference to this subject, we remind that every society, we reject every form of proselytism, and we condemn. He says, it's condemned by the Orthodox. Proselytism practiced in nations already Christian, and in many cases even Orthodox, sometimes through material enticement, by violence, poisons the relations among Christians, and destroys the road to unity. Nowhere in the canons is proselytism condemned, it's commanded. And this is the same stuff that the Patriarch in Russia signs his name to. Bartholomew continues. He says, and he's talking about the Monophysites here. We now clearly realize and understand that our two families have always loyally guarded the same and authentic Christological Orthodox faith and have maintained uninterrupted the apostolic tradition, although they may have used the Christological terms in a different manner. It's a common faith, continued loyalty to the apostolic tradition. This must be the basis of our unity and communion. The two families accept that all the anathemas and the condemnations of the past, which kept us divided, must be lifted, so that the last obstacle to full unity and communion of the two families can be removed. The two families accept the lifting of the anathema, and the condemnations will be based on the fact that the councils and the fathers, previously anathematized or condemned, were not heretics. Now, I can't go into every error he makes here. But here now we have the second time he denies Chalcedon and all the synods that come after it. He says, and he knows that this isn't true, that only terminology divided the two sides, except that every participant there spoke Greek. They can't be loyal to the same apostolic tradition. But what's the Dionysian element here? It's that his invention of doctrine, because he's a pope of something, Pope of Orthodoxy, as the media calls him, that alone produces right. The Apollinarian system says that, of course, it has to be a natural organic system of meaning from which you can deduce certain things. No, this is an inorganic emotional imposition of alien law. See, it doesn't qualify as heresy because it rejects any belief at all. You can't say it's false because the Dionysian rejects those very categories. In fact, categories alone, just by themselves, are foreign to the Dionysian. In an address in 1994, he says, the watchword of the Holy Orthodox Church today is unity. All one family, Roman Catholics, Orthodox, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, and Confucians. Now, at no time in Christian history has unity been a watchword, and watchword is something that defines a movement. He has no authority to say that anyway. But this, as if to prove the Dionysian thesis here, a man who was expert in comparative religion is aware that Buddhism and Confucianism are not religions, and that Judaism largely rejects God entirely. Jews, of course, are not required to denounce their Talmud. Only the Orthodox are asked to denounce themselves. Well, we all know that so much on the founders of ecumenism and corruption have been written in English by people who are far more knowledgeable than I am. These are thoughts about the Patriarch of Constantinople, who is in full communion with the Pope of Rome and has been for some time. But de facto, both men are deposed by their own churches. Now, the Pope's been more successful than Bartholomew, only because Orthodox remains very obscure to the West. I believe firmly that Bartholomew envies Francis for his popularity, although it's only a popularity with atheist liberals and the elites. But these are the last people the scriptures tell us to care about. What they all have in common, all of these types in the Dionysian realm, is an utter obsession with administration, power, and fiat. The Apollinarian is thought according to a cognitive pattern that's found in natural law or some other organic system. But the Dionysian, rather, is a top-down demand or a bottom-up mob. Bottom-up mob, either way. It's not just irrational or untrue, but it rejects those concepts. For both these guys, bishops are the same as the church. The people themselves are utterly meaningless. Usually when I've debated with ecumenists in the past, they actually believe that they're the scholarly ones and that they could condescend to others. They have a caricature of what a traditionalist is in their minds. And that caricature justifies their point of view. Well, the traditionalists cite canons and fathers and everything else. The modernists generally cite modern ideas and modern philosophy as if, well, everyone knows this, so how could you possibly fight it? The Dionysian idea is irrational. It rejects the categories of truth, falsehood, good or bad, because that would vitiate their power over people. When a group or an institution or a person is completely illegitimate and has absolutely no, and this is Machiavelli's whole purpose in writing, that if you're aware that you're illegitimate, if you're aware that you shouldn't be where you are, the only way to sustain your rule is to manipulate people. That's the difference between Dionysian and the Apollinarian in this particular instance. One is this feminine demand, emotional demand for obedience that really has no foundation. Well, the other derives from an organic system of thinking, a system of meaning, a system of concepts that you could deduce the truth from. But to rule, in our case, in the true case, is to follow this system of meanings and to be a part of it, which means you can't do whatever you want. No ruler can be legitimate if he can't rule himself. But the Dionysian idea is that not only should they not rule themselves, but no one should. They'll invent ancient traditions or the idea that the watchword is unity. And it doesn't matter whether or not they actually have an ancient tradition that supports that. Enough people are satisfied with that. I mean, the Antiochians, I've been hearing this for years. There'd be a dozen people by now, including clergy, who give the same slogan. I say, please show me anything in the ancient world that rejected fasting in that period of time, other than the first week afterwards. And of course, they never can. But that's not the point. The point is that they get, you know, power when there's nothing to do. The whole notion of abulia here is that there is nothing worth fighting for. This is classic, you know, Dionysian thinking. We're safe if we're members of an institution. We're safe if we're part of the big church, which is a phrase that I've never forgotten. Many years ago, someone said that. You're not a member of the big church, just a small one? So, well, you know, if that impresses you, you take all the traditionalists, put them together, we're equal in size to our opposition. The schisms that the true Orthodox Church has created are shameful and embarrassing. That indeed comes from the serpent, because it's never, ever, ever, ever doctrinal, which means it has no legitimacy. They split and then later on discover a reason why. The lies that you know, the Greeks said about Auxentius, and then as soon as he was dead, said, yes, we weren't telling the truth. Sorry about that. We were wrong. But still maintain their new church institution. This is typical. And if the true Orthodox Church were unified, we would be far larger than world Orthodoxy. When people come to the church, they don't care about being relevant to modernism. It has to be relevant to something. They want to get out of it. They're coming to the church for the truth. They're coming to the church because the world around them doesn't satisfy them. It's based on Dionysian. It's based on its constant ill will, you know, will, personal will, and bad faith. When you use those two categories, you know, Apollo and Dionysius, and you put the right and left under it, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, the Communist Party and the Soviet Union. If the party does X, X is not only Marxist, but X then is also what the workers want. Whether it is or not isn't important. We say so. Dionysian can be very, very powerful because it unleashes the will that, of course, we have to keep in check. Criminals don't have to worry about following the law, but the cops do. They have no standards. They can do as they please. We, however, have high standards, and we cannot. We're at a disadvantage automatically. The Old Testament explains this in great depth, which is why Jews eventually rejected it in favor of the more power. The Talmud is just about power. They don't believe in law. They believe in manipulating the law. So what I've tried to do here is explain the Dionysian element relative to Bartholomew and his relationship to Francis. Neither one of these men are bishops. Neither one of these men, they're both, by their own canons, in their own church, de facto deposed. There can be no question. But before we go, I want to let you guys know that all true Orthodox people, I don't care what jurisdiction you're in, you're my brothers and my friends. Who your bishop is doesn't matter as far as your adherence to doctrine. If you are a true Orthodox person in doctrine and behavior, you have the Holy Spirit with you. There's no other way to do it without the Holy Spirit. You people aren't Pelagians, right? There's no other way to do it. Doesn't matter who you are in the Orthodox Church. If you're following the traditions and the canons and struggling, then you are my brother and you're my friend. I don't care about jurisdictions. The splits in the true Orthodox Church are humiliating. But that has forced us to recognize one thing. That these schisms and these splits within Orthodoxy are insignificant. They're embarrassing. They're stupid. They hurt us very badly. They cost a lot of money. And they have destroyed our witness to the world. At least to the public. But even the underground church in the Soviet Union was split. They're facing the gulag in the face, and they're anathematizing their brothers. Unity is the watchword, but only within the true Orthodox. I don't care who your bishop is. We know that grace and the Holy Spirit are with you if you are following the doctrine and behaving the way you're supposed to, with all the sins that we all commit. That's not possible without grace. Therefore, you must be true Orthodox in those two areas. So this has nothing to do with jurisdiction, but it does have to do with institutions. Thank you for listening, everyone. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.